everybody. Welcome to Cabination number 353. This is take four to try and get the rundown edition here at the Cabination Lair out for you. This is the Cabination podcast, of course, lovingly nestled along with all of its other episodic friends over at www.caffination.com. I am trying to record this episode with the very last vestiges of energy that are left in my body. I've even tried going to coffee for the seventh or eighth time for the day to try and, but there's only so many times you can go to that well before you just feel it run dry. Coffee can only get you so far, so it's going to be an interesting episode. I'm just going to tell you that much. So far, this is the furthest into the episode I've gotten without, throwing my hands up in disgust and trying to go back and re-record it. So you are hearing what is hopefully only going to stay the fourth edition here of this. So we're just trying to push forward and get all the great news and information that we got coming up for you out in a somewhat coherent fashion. We have a decent amount of Geekcraft lined up. I'd say roughly two-thirds of the episodes thrown into the Geekcraft section here at the Caffeination Podcast. And then we have a decent amount of food and caffeinated bits to round out the show. As always, we're trying to bring you all of the best in technology news and caffeine-related content. So that is what you can hopefully expect from the Caffeination Podcast. Any comments, feedback, suggestion, or hate mail, please feel free to fire it off to caffeination@gmail.com. If you're looking for this episode and any of its other friends, I already told you where to find that, but I did not tell you about the sponsor for today's show. Today's show is sponsored in part by GoToMeeting. Now, there's a lot of great reasons that you should try GoToMeeting. It could be the easy 2-minute automatic setup, literally anybody can do it. It could be the reason that your attendees don't actually need to sign up to the service to actually get the meeting underway. But one of my favorite reasons to suggest people to try this is that you can work and meet from absolutely anywhere. You really can operate without any kind of borders. You can operate without any kind of limitations on yourself. So if you're going on vacation but you still want to get in on that meeting, you can do it with this product. It's a fantastic way to kind of free yourselves from the confines of a lot of the different problems that are out there. You can complete projects faster by showing people what's actually happening on your computer in real time. It allows you to cut out a lot of the prototyping, a lot of the demo model problems, and have everything work in the one individual area. It's incredibly firewall friendly and has a secure data transmission, so every meeting is a secure environment, so you can feel free to talk as you need to. You can start your free 30-day trial today. Just please visit www.gotomeeting.com/tech podcasts. That's www.gotomeeting.com/tech podcasts for a free 30-day trial. I'd like to thank GoToMeeting for being a continued sponsor here at the Caffeination Podcast. They're allowing us to talk about cool things and do all sorts of fun stuff here. So we have a great show lined up for you today. I'd like to think that it follows somewhat of a narrative. We actually had a lot of really good feedback on the privacy episode from the last shot. So in case you didn't hear any of that, we're not going to be replaying that, but there's a couple little things that have continued on there. But Caffeination 352 was actually largely dedicated to privacy issues and digital rights and stuff like that. It might sound boring, but so far everybody seems to have really enjoyed it, so I'd highly suggest you actually go back and check that out. It's very rare that I actually pimp one of my previous episodes on any of the show. They're usually kind of an attempt to stand on their own with the odd reference here or there. But I really think that the last episode actually did a pretty good job of covering some of the stuff. But that's not what we're here to talk to you about today. Today we're here to talk about some of the crazy things that are happening right now. For instance, the first story that we're going to talk to you about is from over at Gizmodo, Top Gear. I don't know if you're familiar with the show. It's a British show where they try all kinds of crazy cool automobiles, where they have some of the most insane test drives and things like that. More often than not, the stars of the show actually attempt to race the different cars across Europe. It's just a really great, really informative, and really kind of witty show. It's just good all the way around. But one of the hosts for the show, James May, is actually attempting to construct a 2-story Lego house. They have over 1 million, let me just see if I have this correct, but they already have the set laid out there. They have more than 3 million blocks that have already been delivered to the building site so far. But seriously, they're actually attempting to build a full-scale working house completely out of Legos. I'm not sure exactly how it's going to work, but who knows. You can head on over there to the BBC site and actually check it out. But they're planning on a working Lego toilet, Lego plumbing, and maybe even parts of a power supply. So this is going to be insane. I'm pretty sure you can't have Lego wires, but I mean, I think everything else in the house they're attempting to build out of Legos. I love this idea. It's insane, but then again, it's Top Gear. Top Gear is supposed to be insane. They're supposed to do things above and beyond exactly what other normal places and people would do. So that's going to be something to really to watch to see exactly how it goes. Next little thing that's up there, you've heard of different computers that have been put together on this show and other shows out of different materials, and there's talk of using holograms for data storage. There's talk of all these different strange upgrades to different facilities that are running computers. But I have yet to hear about something like this. This is a bacterial computer. You heard me correctly. They're actually using bacteria somehow to work with computation. So they're saying that there's a new form of computational bacteria that is actually being tested, and that they're trying to use the bacteria to solve puzzles. And in fact, they allowed for a traveling salesman problem that they were trying to work on. It's also known as a Hamiltonian path problem. Basically, the system is given a bunch of destinations, and it's supposed to find the quickest route to go through all of them. So one of the things they said is, you know, let's just say there's 12 sites in England that they had to visit. What's the quickest way to visit all 12 sites and do it? You know, it's a much harder problem than you would originally think. And in order for a computer to do it, the computer has to go down every possible explanation of which path would be which before it actually gets there. And it has to do it sequentially. I mean, even no matter how fast, you know, how many flops per second, I forget what the actual measurement's called, but no matter how many flops per second, computer still has to go, you know, 1, 2, 3. No matter even if it goes 1, 2, 3 or 1, 2, 3 right in a row. I mean, it's still going in a sequential order. They say that somehow the bacterial method, I'm still a little bit fuzzy on how this actually works, and fuzzy might be a little bit more of a descriptive term than we're actually used to having in a computational environment. But they're saying bacteria, because it multiplies and because of the way that they somehow used and modified this, it was able to attack every solution to the problem instantaneously, or rather to work on multiple paths at the same point in time. And that as the bacteria actually increased, as they multiplied, the rate at which the problem was solved actually increased exponentially. So if you look at the overall progression of solving a problem, so if you were to look at from no solution to having a solution, is, you know, like a 1 to 100 thing, as they get closer to 100, it actually sped up, which is kind of crazy to really think about. So I really don't know how they're actually doing this. They're saying that the problem they attempted to solve has over 3.5 million possible routes to choose from, and a regular computer actually had to go through one of them, you know, everything one at a time. So I have no idea how you would end up programming bacteria. So they said the bacteria produced the correct answer in incredibly quicker time. So it's gonna be kind of interesting to see how this ends up working into a laptop. I don't want to have to breed my next computer. I don't want to have to go to a lab and have it grown in a petri dish. And there's a couple little funny sci-fi things that this kind of makes you feel about. It's like, okay, so we're growing bacteria that are capable of solving problems in a very general sense. So what's going to happen first? Are we going to turn something into the Borg, or is something going to somehow be released as a zombie virus? So it's just weird all over. So I just wanted to kind of pass that along. All right, next little piece of information, piece of news that's making the rounds right now is the Hubble snares pictures of Jupiter's newest scar. Now, this is an article specifically from over at Wired. Now, if you are unaware of what's been happening, I think on the 21st or 22nd of July 2009, there was a large object that hit Jupiter. It was either a comet or a asteroid, and they're saying that it was huge, and it was that the actual object has a crater the size of the Pacific Ocean. Now, there's a couple different fun facts about this collision. First of all, it was observed by an amateur astronomer before any of the big telescopes that were out there. Then as soon as that was observed, and you never actually see something hit, you know, you don't get to track the thing going across the sky until it hit Jupiter. You see the aftermath, and there's this giant dark spot that appeared on the planet, and the planet is so many times bigger than Earth that it's kind of crazy to see. Now, there's a couple different theories that have been pushed out there, and I didn't actually go through and link to all the different articles, but I just wanted to link up to the Hubble picture because it's gorgeous. I mean, most of the pictures taken from Hubble are actually gorgeous, but this is insane. And if you look at the scale, the dark spot that actually appears over at Wired is actually the size of the Pacific Ocean. So if you take that and extrapolate it out onto how big the planet is, you get a whole new mess of fluid dynamics that are running through there. So it's just insane. But they're saying a couple of the different theories that have been put forward are that somehow the origins of life on Earth are a direct result of the fact that we have such a large planet in the solar system. You know, Jupiter basically sucks up through its gravitational pull and through its just sheer size, sucks up a lot of the extraplanetary objects that might have, you know, impacted Earth otherwise. So they're saying, you know, if you go back into the end of the Cretaceous period, you know, you have that one massive asteroid that actually landed in the Yucatan Peninsula, which probably prompted the extinction of the dinosaurs. If you have that, you know, and you have all the evidence that's associated with that, that was a relatively small asteroid that hit, and it caused massive global climate change. So if you take that and you kind of expand it to the size of some of the objects that have hit Jupiter in the past, and you kind of get to realize where, you know, that planet really ends up protecting us for a lot of the different things that are out there. And there's even some theories that have been put forward that a lot of the extra things that are present on Earth, or some of the gases and things like that, are possibly the result, and some of the other planets that are in the solar system. I couldn't actually find the article for this. I read it earlier today, and I'm kicking myself for not linking it. But they're saying some of the smaller planets in the inner ring of the solar system might be direct results of much larger bodies of something hitting Jupiter and spinning off in a closer orbit towards the sun. So that Earth might not necessarily be Earth, you know, Venus, Jupiter, or no, sorry, it's like Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars might not necessarily have originated within this solar system, but they might be a result of, you know, debris collecting after colliding with Jupiter. So, and, you know, that's obviously billions of years in the past, and you're never going to figure all that stuff out. But it's kind of interesting to just play around with some of the shoulda, coulda, wouldas and the possibilities that are laying back there. All right, moving right along to something a little bit more terrestrial and something much more geeky. But there's so many cool and interesting concept devices that are out there that it's kind of hard to make the jump from a conceptual article and say, hey, yeah, you know, this is really neat and I'm going to talk about it, to actually being able to tell you that there's a product coming out that looks as awesome as some of the concept devices that are out there. Imagine a Bluetooth headset that actually appeared as a ring that you would wear on your finger. If you look down, there's actually an organic light-emitting diode that's actually wrapped around the outside of the ring that would show you incoming caller ID things. So you'd look down, you say, okay, you know, my mom's calling. You could take the ring off your finger, spin it, and basically split it in half and spin it on one of the axes so that it actually turned into a big S curve. So, you know, it would stay connected at one point. You'd spin it around, and when you clicked it into place, it would actually become a Bluetooth earpiece that you could hook over your ear. Now, it doesn't look like it would stay there for very long, but then again, it wouldn't have to. The idea is that it's supposed to be a lightweight and easily portable device that you can, you know, move from one place to another. Now, this looks exactly like it would be off-the-wall, crazy concept device. However, it's going to be retailing for $129, or the deluxe edition where that has the display on the outside for $175 in 2010. April of 2010. This is the craziest and coolest Bluetooth headset that I've ever seen. Now, the only thing is, I wonder how long it actually keeps a charge, because one of the issues that I have with my Bluetooth headset is that I don't use them frequently enough, I guess, but every time I need to use it, I actually have to charge it beforehand, so I'm going to have to think about making sure that everything works. What they need to do is they need to make a Bluetooth headset that plugs into your phone that actually charges from there, you know, so that way you could just detach it from the bottom of the phone or something like that. Yes, it would kind of leech off the battery life of your phone, but it's one device you have to charge instead of two, so... This thing looks cool. I don't have that kind of disposable income to waste on a cool spiffy gadget, but if they'd like to send one to me to review, I'd gladly, you know, send it back after I was done, but still, it just looks so awesome. I can't wait to actually see it in the actual field tests, because you know a lot of the bigger websites are going to have that kind of stuff that's out there. But we bring you the real cool stuff. We'll talk about it. We just don't ever get sent the funny products like that. All right, now the next cool thing that's up here is, we're not talking about the dog translator from Up, which if you haven't seen the movie yet, you really need to go out there and see it. It's Pixar, so you know it's beautiful, and it's Pixar, so you know that they have a couple really cool and poignant moments in there. But there's one really great comic relief moment that happens throughout most of the movie, centering around a translator that's attached to a dog, and it's not a talking dog like, you know, Bolt is or some of the other characters that are out there. It's actually a dog. As you would imagine a dog speaking, you know, it's like, so they get interrupted and they go squirrel right in the middle of a sentence. And taking that idea and moving beyond, there's actually something called a bilingual dog translator that's being pushed out in Japan. Now, in order to actually use this thing, you're going to need to learn Japanese. So you're going to need a translator for the translator, and who knows what your dog's going to end up saying that. But apparently all dogs speak Japanese, according to this thing. If you have $213, you can actually buy this thing and, you know, and actually you know, figure out what your dog is saying. It's kind of fun. Funny, because as I've been watching the Dog Whisperer lately, he keeps talking about different interesting, which is a fantastic program, and I really have to thank Mass for turning me on to that one. When we first got the dog, he said that was one of his favorite shows, talking about dog training. But some of the things that he says, you know, certain breeds are more vocal than others, and I think we actually have an incredibly vocal dog as opposed to some of the other ones that are out there. She barks and growls and makes a lot of funny noises for everything. So it'd be kind of interesting to see exactly what they all mean, as opposed to trying to actually spend the time to sit there and figure it out. But I'm a very big proponent of, if you spend more time with your dog, you're going to figure out what it means. You don't necessarily need your bilingual translator, so who knows how well it's going to work, or if it's just going to be one of those things that you see in the fishing aisle. My grandfather, who I owe 99% of my fishing knowledge to, used to walk through some of the aisles for fishing equipment in... you know, sports stores and stuff like that, sporting equipment stores, and, you know, point to some of the more expensive and colorful lures that were up there. He said, "You know what those are for?" I said, "No." He said, "Those are for catching fishermen." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, that, you know, basically those things are to pull in people buying the lures. They're not necessarily to pull in the fish." And he would go and grab a pack of hooks and a pack of split shot for significantly less money. So it's just one of those funny things where every once in a while I see something that's designed to catch people rather than to actually do what it's supposed to do. So, all right, moving right along, something even more cool. It's how would you like to drive on trees? Yeah, wooden wheels are coming back, but not in the way that you actually think. Oregon State University has kind of tried to change the chemical composition of tires that are out there. One of the components within the vulcanized rubber that you are currently driving on right now, whether or not you are driving on, whether or not you're riding a bike or driving a car, is silica. And silica takes a lot to extract, and it's it has a larger carbon footprint to actually get it out there. And it does certain things to the tires. What the Oregon State has actually attempted to do is extracting microcrystalline cellulose from plant fiber, which does not necessarily mean that you're going to be driving on wood, and it only replaces 12% of the silica in the tires, but it does have different... It creates tires that actually have slightly different characteristics. It does not lose any of the traction in wet conditions, but it does increase your traction in dry conditions. So it basically decreases rolling resistance during dry summer months. So it's actually going to, if this thing comes to pass and comes to fruition as they think it should, it's going to decrease the amount of energy it would take to have your car continue to roll during dry conditions, which would hopefully decrease the amount of energy that you would need to spend to drive your car around. So it seems kind of interesting. They're still trying to work on durability testings, and despite the attention-grabbing headlines that are out there, it's like, hey, OSU foresters swap tree fibers for rubber in fuel-efficient tires. So that makes kind of a broad, sweeping generalization. It's a much more complicated and intricate little process where they're actually replacing one of the components in tires with, you know, incredibly highly processed, plant cellulose. They say that it actually takes less energy overall to actually do the process to extract the plant cellulose than it does to extract the silica. So it's going to be interesting to see if they are as durable as some of the other ideas that are out there. Now, we've talked a little bit about things that are coming to fruition that were once concepts, but this is something that I thought was a concept that I wanted to kind of push out there because I thought it was pretty cool. This is a wooden ruler with LEDs inside of it that actually tell you how long the distance that you're measuring. So the idea behind this is completely concept. There's no actual working prototype even out on the market or anything. But the idea is that there's a conducive strip that's on the side, so as you take your pencil and you trace a length of anything, as you draw a straight line on the side of this straight edge, it actually will show you how long of a line you have drawn. There's a couple cool things about this. First of all, it's very cool that they actually have the display on there. And the only other thing is there's no indicators on the actual ruler itself for how long you're doing it. Inches, centimeters, anything. Nothing else is marked out there. So, of course, you would need some way to tell how long of a line you just drew with your straight edge. I thought it was pretty cool and everything. There's a lot of interesting little ideas that they put out there, but I think they have one concept device built that's not actually built into wood. It's built into like a plastic thing. So it's an interesting idea. I wonder how practical it would be in the long run, but I just wanted to kind of push it out there because I thought it was pretty cool. Iconic Hanker think tank from Boston, the Loft people, have come back online after a 10-year hiatus. Now, if you were active in the security community in the early to mid 90s, you are familiar. I think they went up to mid 90s, but Loft was a huge influence in a lot of the early hacker information that was pushed out there. I mean, I don't even think it was early. It was much more late information that was being pushed out there. I think the earlier stuff, I mean, 2600 has been around since the early 80s. So there was a collection of 8 security-minded individuals who all operated in the Boston area, and they put out a lot of different security advisories, and there was some sort of animosity as the actual think tank broke up and they attempted to try and make money doing what they were doing. As you know, money tends to ruin most really good concepts. Well, time has apparently softened a lot of the wounds that are out there, and 6 of the 8 gentlemen are actually back in the saddle, at least temporarily, and they're trying to work on a new version of Loft, and they're calling some of the stuff the Hacker News Network. So if you go on over to hackernews.com, you can see the HNN cast for July 24th, 2009. I think the more they do this, the more comfortable that they're actually going to be in front of the camera, and they actually give you a really cool and hardcore security perspective on a lot of the different news that's out there. And whereas I will talk in passing about some of the security issues that are out there, I'm not going to start dissecting bugs that are out in some of the different things. Say if Adobe had patched X, Y, or Z, there wouldn't be problems like there are now, because first of all, I might not know anything that I'm talking about, and second of all, I really kind of think that there's other venues for that that's out there that are better qualified to talk about it. If you have issues, you can talk to me, and you know, I should be able to point you in the direction of the correct news sources. But this is a much more technical version of what a podcast should be. So it's really kind of cool to see some of the stuff that they're putting out there. They're saying that they're officially going to be launching the Hacker News Network on 01/11/10. So in 2010, you're going to see the true version of what Hacker News Network is going to be. But it's kind of interesting to see them getting back into the fray, and it's going to be really cool to see what they come up with. So welcome back into the conversation, gentlemen. All right, what killed handwriting? There's an interesting article over at Time and CNN.com that's actually mourning the death of handwriting, as the title of the article is. The weird thing is, I'm talking about an article that hasn't been written yet, because it's dated August 3rd, 2009, and as of the recording of this episode of the Caffeination, it's only the 27th of July, so I'm not sure if this is going to be pushed out for that version of the printed magazine, but still, it's kind of weird to see a predated article like that out there. But there's a lot of people that blame the fact that nobody has good handwriting on computers, whereas this article kind of delves deeper into it and say, you know, over the past 100 years, the idea of teaching somebody how to write cursive, at least in the American school systems, has kind of lost its luster, and it's degraded over time. If you look at my parents' handwriting, it is so much more pristine than either mine or my sister's. And there's people that are younger than either my sister or myself who have just kind of descended into this strange printed script. And I'm not talking about the friends that I have that are in architecture, because for some reason, all architects print everything. It's probably because they're so used to doing lettering on drawings that it's just that much quicker. And they have incredibly neat and precise handwriting as they're printing. They just can't write cursive at all. I don't know why. I still write a fair amount. I still do a lot of writing to try and, you know, work and taking notes and things. So I have a very illegible script, as the case may be, but I still know how they're supposed to look, and I know that I have bad handwriting. And I'm pretty sure with practice I probably could have gotten better earlier on, but it was kind of glossed over after maybe about third grade. And at that point, you know, you just had to make sure the teacher could read what you were attempting to write. I know I have horrible spelling, and I'm not about to blame that on computers either, because even though we had computers in the classroom, they didn't have any kind of spell check at that point. It was just laziness on my part. But it's interesting to read the article, and they're saying that basically it's not necessarily the computers that are to blame, but rather the educational system that is focused less on handwriting and more on other things. So it's kind of interesting to see computers be exonerated for some things that are out there. All right, next little thing we have up here is an article on standard def in gaming. Now, if you're unfamiliar with what standard def is, if you have an old TV that's up there that doesn't have high def, doesn't have special antennas, and you can't see, like, you know, pores on somebody's face, you have a standard definition television. I have one in the basement, and they're saying that there's a lot of interesting things that are happening in the realm of high definition gaming, where, you know, you can see certain different aspects of how people are supposed to look. But there's also a lot of inefficient display of these video games. Basically, your consoles are working overtime to display high definition graphics on low definition television sets. And even though you have to choose what you would like to display, you know, for instance, on the Xbox 360, I know there's something that says, what are you, you know, basically, how would you like me to format the output? What do you want to see on the TV? And you can pick what kind of TV you're displaying it on. They're saying game developers and designers are trending to the higher definition television sets, where most of the people that are actually playing the games are still playing them on standard definition television sets. So it's an incredibly inefficient algorithm being used to produce what's on the screen. So there's wasted cycles there because nobody's ever going to see anything. And one of my own personal notes that I'd like to put in there is I really hate the fact that some of the game designers have designed text so small that unless you have a spiffy TV or something like that, you can't actually read it on a standard definition television. So there's mission printouts and things like that in games like Armored Core 4 and a couple other ones that are out there. Madden's really bad with it, where you put it up on the screen, you just kind of have to, like, stand back, squint, kind of figure it out what the jumble of white pixels is supposed to actually read. So it's an interesting problem that I know is only going to get worse unless you upgrade your TV going forward, because they see the high end, they see what they're able to actually display and work with, and they don't actually take into account anybody who, you know, just doesn't have enough money to drop an extra $1,000 on a TV that's going to sit in the basement. All right, moving right along. Funny little things that are being put out there. There's a website called Geek Stuff For You, and they're advertising a really kind of cool NES controller type card case. It's a business card case that is designed to look very similar to the original Famicom controllers, not the original Nintendo controllers. Nintendo's controllers are NES, Nintendo Entertainment System controllers in the United States were gray, black, and red. In Japan, they were kind of a maroonish light cherry, I guess, and a beige. At least the controllers were, and some of the systems had a little bit of gray thrown in as well. Well, that is the form factor of these business card cases that they're actually being put out there. So it was knocked down from 4,000 yen, and currently, given the climate that's out there, if you type the just 29,000 or 2,900 yen rather into Google, it says that it's roughly $30.60 for a business card case that it's made out of metal. It's a little bit high quality. It's not necessarily overkill, but it's definitely something that be a little bit of geek cred if you had one of those. I just use a vendor given business card wallet. Has a little USB thumb drive that sticks in the front. That's all I've ever tried to use. I don't really have too much use to give out business cards, except at a couple of the different conferences that we go to. And then you need to carry so many of them that the thin little business card carrying cases that they have are a little bit inefficient. So if you have the need to carry business cards in a much more professional fashion, then you can always drop $30 on something like this. I think it's pretty cool, just a little bit out of the league for something that I would need. Alright, moving right along, the modded Roomba doesn't just pick things up, it hands them to you. Again, another story from over at Gizmodo. Somebody modified a Roomba to actually, be able to pick up things as small as a quarter. There's an interesting little video over at Gizmodo. Now, there's interesting possibilities for this beyond just having something that's really kind of cool and having a robot that can go around and pick things up for you. They're saying that this kind of technology might be able to be used for elderly, infirm, or just people who are plain lazy. And I really like the idea of this. I mean, could you imagine having a Roomba in the house with somebody's grandmother or something like that? She drops the remote. She can't go get it. The Roomba scoots over, grabs the remote, and then comes back. A little robot that plays fetch with you is kind of an interesting idea. And taking that one step further and kind of going off-road, so to speak, over at Ogizmo, they have solar-powered pool skimmers. Cleans your pools so you don't have to. The article that they have up there talks about a lot of the work that ends up going into having a nice and well-kept pool. And it is hard work, and you can see that. And one of the most irritating chores is having to constantly skim the pool water with stuff, especially if you have a tree that overhangs your pool. So the idea of having a floating robot run around and kind of scoop up some of the stuff that's floating is really kind of cool, and the fact that it's solar-powered means it never has to go back into a charging dock as long as you have a relatively well-lit yard. No word on how... Oh, sorry, this thing has a $500 price tag, so if you have a nice big pool in your backyard and you have that kind of dough floating around, first of all, you could send some over to the Caffeination Podcast, or you could just buy one of these and call it a day and just let me know that you have it and take videos of it scooting around the pool, because I think that would be pretty cool too. Then the last little thing we have for you here in the Caffeination Podcast in the Geek Cruft section is Beware of Arming the Robots, an interesting little comic from over at Least I Could Do, one of my favorite comics that's out there. There's an interesting little story arc where the main character Rain bought a Roomba, and he named it Skynet. They said, well, why does it have a knife taped to it? It says, when it rises up against us, I want it to remember who armed it first. So, just kind of dovetailing into the robot overlord thing that we talk about quite often here on the Caffeination Podcast. You can make your own jokes. I'm not even going to attempt to do that. Alright, that about wraps it up for the Geek Cruft section. We have a great little couple little things in the food and caffeinated bits, and then we'll send you out on your way. In case you were looking for this podcast, it is lovingly nestled over at www.caffeinaton.com, caffeination.com, and all comments, feedback, suggestion, or hate mail can be fired off to caffeination@gmail.com. First thing that's up there is Stir Crazy. I love this. This is an interesting little remote stirring mechanism that allows you to just put this thing. It's called a stir, lends an extra hand in the kitchen. So basically, it's a four-armed thing that you put in a pot. It's the easiest way to describe it. But imagine kind of like if a whisk exploded. You put the handle in the center of the pot, and there's four prongs that go down into the food, and then it has a series of contraptions that basically stir whatever it is that you have in the pot around. Now, this is good for sauces or other things that have to be constantly stirred. It might even be good for fondue or something like that. I love the idea of having these simple little kitchen gadgets. Now, this thing's around $25. So if you do a lot of cooking for sauces and stuff like that, this will probably pay for itself so that you can, you know, do other things in your kitchen. But it's a little bit steep of a price tag, and it's not yet, you know, real cheap. I don't know what the price point would be for something like this. Right now, all I know is that I would use it so infrequently. $25 is something that I'm probably not going to throw at it. But I could definitely see the utility if you were somebody who uses that kind of stuff a lot. It's really hard to explain and kind of hard to draw a visual. But imagine something like a from War of the Worlds just sitting over your Alfredo sauce, and you can kind of figure out what it sort of looks like. It's kind of funny. So, but $25 isn't bad. It's like right on the edge of the price point for something that I could see being really, really useful. There's a contest run by James Dyson, the vacuum cleaner guy, that, you know, basically looks for better designs and products that are out there. And one of the submissions is actually a shrinking jug that keeps milk fresh for an extra week. The idea behind this specifically is that as you empty milk out of a carton, the more air that's actually inside of the container actually contributes to the milk going bad sooner. So the idea behind this is that the container collapses. I'm pretty sure you could use this for almost any kind of beverage or actually anything. Just it's a generalized storing container that actually shrinks down to fit it. This one's actually just contained enough so that you can actually use it for something like milk. I like the idea. It's still just a concept, and I kind of hope that this thing actually wins. But this is just one entry that I wanted to kind of pass along because I thought it was really cool. All right, next little thing that we have up for you here is a story from over at CoffeeHero.com. Our friend Mass actually did a review of Cereal Vit Coffee Flakes. Now, this is a breakfast cereal that's actually being put out there that's supposed to be coffee flavored. And Mass went one more and not just he didn't just try the coffee cereal out and say, hey, you know, it's really good or really bad. He actually brought it to a meeting of the coffee club in Seattle and had everybody try it. So 11 people actually tried it, and they said everybody loved the cereal, which is high praise. And they said it's not a strong coffee flavor. It's kind of a mild coffee flavor that kind of kicks in after the fact. And it's really interesting. It's gluten-free, organic. It has 140 milligrams of omega-3 per serving. It's made in Italy. It's cornflakes coated with real Italian coffee. So kind of interesting. It's one of those things where I'm probably going to have to see if I can get a box of this stuff because it looks interesting, and I love coffee. I also like breakfast cereal from time to time. And it has a high snack quotient is what I would say. I like things that have a nice big crunch and have kind of uniform pieces. It's like Raisin Bran with the nut cluster. Is not really snackable because it's kind of all different sizes and stuff like that. It has sugar coatings and stuff like this. So with these, it looks much more along the lines of cereal or, of course it's cereal, much more along the lines of like puffed wheat or something like that with actual flavor. So you can head on over to CoffeeHero.com to read Mass's full rundown of it, and you can actually check out where you can buy it and request it for your supermarket. I'd like to thank him for putting such an interesting and cohesive piece up, reviewing it, doing your grubs, pushing it out there to so many other people to actually give it a run through as well. And the last little thing that we're going to talk to you about here today on the Caffeination Podcast before I completely collapse from lack of energy is how to clean your coffee grinder. Now, there's a whole bunch of different ways out there. Most people use, you know, soap and water, and I've been looking for an interesting way to actually clean mine because I have a burr grinder and it's a pain in the rear end to actually clean the thing anymore. So this is a really interesting and offbeat way of doing it. They say take plain long grain white rice and actually run it through the coffee grinder, and what it does is the starches in the white rice actually attract the oils from the coffee bean and actually soak some of it up as it goes through. And then since you're running the larger grain white rice through it, you're supposed to set it to a very fine grind on the burr grinder. Or you can do the same thing with your blade grinder, just, you know, wail at it for a little bit. But they say running a couple passes of white rice actually through it will clean out a lot of the grounds that have been stuck in there, will really kind of attract and knock out the oils that have build up on the inside of the thing as well. Now, at some point, you're going to have to run other coffee through it to kind of get the last remnants of the white rice out there, but they're saying since the white rice doesn't have any oil content of its own, there's going to be a lot less of it stuck inside the machine. So I like this. This is definitely going to be one of those things I could see keeping just like a bag of real cheap white rice around for, so... We usually have brown rice here, but I mean, hey, how much is a bag of the really cheap white rice to kind of run through the machine to give it a nice little one, you know, cleaning every once in a while? I like it, and since it was really kind of an off-the-beaten-path kind of solution to a problem, I definitely wanted to push it out there. All right, that about wraps it up here today for the Caffeination Podcast. This has been episode number 353. I know I'm forgetting something somewhere in the episode, so... 1,000 apologies if I forgot to put something in there, but I have to edit this episode down now. So thank you so much for listening. This episode and all of its friends are listed over at www.caffeination.com, caffeination.com. All comments, feedback, suggestion to caffeination@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening, and stay caffeinated, people.